This is Culturetopia, a weekly look at NPR's best in movies, books, TV, music, and culture. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Felix Contreras, arts producer and reporter for the Arts Desk here at NPR.
This week, we have an interview with Gabriel Byrne, the star of HBO's In Treatment, who will talk about his show and about the art of listening.
We also have Anika Noni Rose.
And NPR's Tom Cole will talk about some of the first records that introduced him to jazz.
Jazz, dear to my heart.
Absolutely.
But here we go. But first, this past Sunday, a brand new movie prequel to The Lord of the Rings premiered. It's a 40-minute high-definition film released only over the internet. Now, this prequel was made by fans who earned no profit on it. Still, NPR's Laura Seidel reports that the producers are walking a fuzzy legal line.
The Hunt for Gollum looks just like the Hollywood version. I was fooled the first time I saw it.
Precious.
The actors are dead ringers for the stars of The Lord of the Rings. The costumes appear identical. The special effects in the trailer are flawless. But The Hunt for Gollum is the work of 150 volunteers.
We're essentially a bunch of fans and enthusiast filmmakers making this unofficially.
Chris Bouchard is the director. He's been working on this 40-minute mini-feature for 2 years. He made up the plot, which focuses on a search to find the deranged Gollum. The fear is that Gollum might reveal the whereabouts of the magic ring to the powers of darkness.
I guess this story is really just a small chapter when you compare to a full feature film. But we tried to expand it a bit and try and show the epic scale of Middle-earth as well in kind of a tribute to what Peter Jackson did.
Of course, Academy Award-winning screenwriter and director Peter Jackson might not consider this production a tribute. Nor might New Line Cinema, which produced the Lord of the Rings trilogy into film, or J.R.R. Tolkien's family, which owns the rights to his books.
Well, I think it's an interesting question.
Fred von Lohmann is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Von Lohmann says it's not really clear whether or not Bouchard and his crew of volunteers are in violation of the copyright for Tolkien's work. Von Lohmann says fans have always written their own stories based on TV shows and movies. That's legal. But a high-quality movie available over the internet could change the game.
Now the fans can reach a global audience immediately through the internet. And now we have video hosting sites that can, you know, make that available in a global way.
Von Lohmann says he could imagine a court might decide that The Hunt for Gollum violates the copyright of the Tolkien family because it may get in the way of their right to make money on licensing and franchising. The entire 40-minute film will be released on Sunday in HD on the internet.
And if you go to the website, you click on the clip.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, it says a film by fans for fans. Then you see the clip. And at the end, it says The Hunt for Gollum, by permission, Rickety Shack's film. So NPR had to get permission to use it.
Very interesting under the circumstances. It's so funny because it says by fans for fans. One of the things that strikes me so funny about this is it has the potential to create complete havoc for fans because these are exactly the kinds of fans who will have endless debates over what is and is not what they will call canon. Is this really part of the story or not part of the story? And so, I mean, it would seem to me this could create complete fan pandemonium.
One thing that's not up for debate is the success of HBO's series In Treatment among fans and critics. Now, in the show, actor Gabriel Byrne plays a psychoanalyst, which mostly means scenes of one person talking while another person's listening.
You make him sound perfect.
Is that bad?
Can you think of a downside to it?
Well, a downside to having a father who loves me? No. The problem is, I can't find anybody as good as him.
You think there's something wrong with that, don't you?
Well, for one thing, your father is married to your mother. Do you think there's any connection between that and your picking married men?
I said that I was done with that.
You did. But you also asked me what that pattern was about.
Now you're going to tell me that my father molested me? Huh? Because he didn't.
I didn't think that. But your father has been an essential comfort for you. For as long as you're his favorite, you won't ever be alone. I'm getting the feeling that the tight bond isn't entirely comfortable.
Fresh Air's Terry Gross recently spoke to Byrne about the show, and in this clip we'll listen in on his thoughts about the art of listening.
I had never been in therapy. I had known a few psychotherapists, but never actually took part in the process myself. But I understood that it was about listening. And listening, I think, is one of the most profound compliments that you can pay to another person, to truly listen. And to feel that you're heard is deeply fulfilling in a deep human way. I knew it was about that. The thing was how to make drama out of listening. And so therefore, television, because it uses the close-up so frequently, allows you to do that, because by some magic alchemy, if you're thinking something or feeling it, the camera will capture it.
You said this is a series that's in part about listening, that your job, your role, your performance is in part about listening. That's one of the reasons why I love the series, because it's about listening and often about asking good questions. That's theoretically what I'm supposed to be doing on the show.
Yeah.
So, well, it's like you've heroicized the act of listening.
Yes, I think that it's, as I said, listening is a really profound thing to do. I mean, we hear sometimes, but we don't actually really listen. And when we start to listen, it's the beginning of a deeper awareness.
But listening isn't a great visual experience. Like, watching somebody listen isn't usually a great visual experience. I know from the very few times I did television that when the camera would come on me, when I was listening to somebody's answer to my question, I would look, inert, which you as an actor can't afford to look on camera. So what do you need to do to make listening an action that the camera can really pick up?
Now, the challenge of acting is that you don't hear everything just once. You have to hear it several times, because you have to do take after take after take. But to constantly be absorbed and to try to be outside yourself so that you're not aware of listening, because really, truly, profoundly listening is to be unaware of yourself at a deep level. So you asked me if I had done any research for this. I had seen priests in confession, obviously being a Catholic brought up in Ireland. I had seen how they sometimes perfunctorily listened, because there's many ways of pretending to listen. And I also find that very interesting to observe, the way people fake listening and fake engagement. And I knew that if this thing was going to succeed, it had to be... that had to be convincing first and foremost. And I watched, you talk about yourself as an interviewer, I watched Dick Cavett tapes, and I was very keenly interested in the way that he didn't always have the right question. And sometimes he got a little bit uncomfortable, and sometimes his body language was a little uncomfortable as well. And that to me looked like real, as opposed to, convince everybody that I'm totally comfortable and everything is going smoothly. Sometimes silence is more powerful than the actual words that are spoken. And silence is something that, say, somebody like Harold Pinter or Beckett in the theater really truly understood, that words sometimes are not more powerful than silence.
You can hear the full 40-minute interview with Gabriel Byrne at our website, npr.org.
You know, the show's drama arc, as he stated, are the stories told while listening and his reactions to them. And it made me think of other things on the big and small screen, other things that I remember that were good examples of listening. Famously, My Dinner with Andre. And then other therapist examples, like The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
And then way back when, Ordinary People.
And I have to say, I would also think of, when you mentioned My Dinner with Andre, it made me think of Before Sunrise with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, where they got off the train in Europe and they sort of spent the night. And it's all just, once again, people talking, conversation. Nothing else really happens in the entire movie. So,
And it goes along with his concluding statement where he says, words do not always have more power than silence.
Absolutely.
I like that. I think you can detect a bit of Ireland in Gabriel Byrne's accent. And this week, NPR's Jackie Lydon spoke with an author of a novel set in Ireland.
She spoke to author Colm Toybean about his novel Brooklyn, his first since The Master, a book that was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2004.
In his new novel, his main character, Elise Lacy, is setting out for America in the early 1950s.
Elise lives alone in Brooklyn, but not entirely alone. She goes to a boarding house, which is run by an Irish landlady. Her landlady is Mrs. Keough, a very central figure here.
Yeah, I couldn't resist the boarding house. I thought what fun you could have with all the lodgers arriving and Mrs. Keough, who runs the boarding house, being so bossy and bad at certain times and demanding no one is allowed to talk about boyfriends. Boyfriends banned. Politics banned. So basically they just talk about clothes and Mrs. Keough bosses them. And every time I wrote a line for her, I have to say, I almost laughed myself the next thing Mrs. Keough was going to say. I mean, for example, Mrs. Keough doesn't think she'll buy a television, although a friend of hers has one, because she isn't sure they'll keep making programs. And she could be left with this television with nothing on it, and she didn't want to be caught like that.
Yes, although she's a strict one. Exile is a theme in this book. Why can't the exiled immigrants relate what's happening to them to the people back home? As it happens, I mean, Elise never tells her mother the truth about her life. She's essentially leading a double life.
I think that was one of the things that happened, especially in Ireland, that you left in order to improve yourself. And you couldn't write home and tell people, look, I'm really lonely, because you'd realize how much those letters were going to matter, that you needed to put good news or uplifting news into them. People learn to play that game. In a way, it's something Henry James dealt with very well, that business of silence, of withholding information, of concealing things.
You can read an excerpt of Brooklyn at the book section of our website, npr.org.
And from Irish immigrants to African detectives and princesses, sort of.
Sort of. Anika Noni Rose plays opposite soul singer turned actress Jill Scott in the HBO series The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. Now, she's won a Tony on Broadway in the hit Caroline or Change, and she also held her own in the film Dreamgirls.
And this week, NPR's Michelle Norris spoke with her about her next role as Disney's first black princess in the long-awaited film The Princess and the Frog.
Can I ask you about your next project?
Yes.
There is a lot of anticipation about The Princess and the Frog. You're going to voice the character Tiana. Oprah Winfrey will voice your mother's character, Eudora. The tale is set in New Orleans. What else can you tell us about it?
Well, we have a magnificent cast. Jennifer Lewis is playing Mama Odie, who is our fairy godmother, for lack of a better title. John Goodman is in it. Terrence Howard is playing my dad. And, you know, the list just goes on. It's so much fun. I just have never done anything like this before, and it has been a dream of mine my entire life since I was watching The Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights with Tinkerbell flitting around and when you dish about a stool at the end of it, and that was the night you get to stay up late before you have to go to school the next day. I have always wanted to do a voice, and it is a joy.
Sounds like fun. It sounds like fun. Now, after that pantheon of Disney princesses, Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella and Jasmine and Ariel, and now Tiana, is it an important milestone for you to break the color line for Disney?
Well, the interesting thing is that I didn't think about it that way. I just thought I wanted to do Disney animation. And this came up. Here's what's important about it. I love the fact that young black girls can go out for Halloween and look like the princess that they want to look like this year. I think it's a wonderful thing not to have to throw the towel over your head to create some hair that matches the television screen. There's something about looking at something familiar. I mean, I really do remember having a yellow towel on my head, flinging my head back and forth like a complete fool. I remember the first time I went to a birthday party at a friend of mine's house, and it was a swimming party. And this was pre-perm, because, you know, you don't do relaxers when you're a little person. You let your hair be, which is good. But I jumped in the pool, and I was a water baby, and I swam, and I swam, and I swam, and I jumped out, and my hair flung around for a minute, and then it stopped. And somebody asked me what was wrong with my hair. And I went in the bathroom, I looked at my little hair, And it was looking like a forest of trees because it had curled right up. And I wished so badly that that was not the case at that time.
You were still at the party, but your hair went back home.
My hair went home deep. My hair went to Mama Cootsie. And that's a very interesting thing. And it wasn't that I felt uncomfortable being black or wanted to be something else. I just noticed that things were different. But I think that it's about celebrating the things that are different, or at least saying that different is pretty all right.
I can't wait to see it.
And now, all this talk of princesses, I'm thinking of a song segue to our next story. And the song is Someday My Prince Will Come from Disney's Snow White.
Yes.
Now, that song became a jazz standard by Miles Davis and a whole bunch of other people, and that's what we're going to talk about next.
Yep. April was Jazz Appreciation Month, and for NPR Music's Take 5 series, NPR Music Editor Tom Cole spoke with Michelle Martin of Tell Me More about some of the first jazz records he ever heard.
So how did you get into jazz?
Well, I was mostly into rock and roll and blues, acoustic blues, and there was a particular record store here in Washington where I grew up. That I would go to, and one day I just decided to ask the jazz buyer to educate me. And so that's how I got started. His name was Thomas Paul. Everybody called him TP. And
he took to his task.
He did.
Did he have kind of a set curriculum, as it were, to introduce people, or did he just size you up and think, this is what this guy would like?
I think it was more the latter. It was definitely not what you would call a sort of standard jazz primer. No New Orleans jazz, no Louis Armstrong, no Duke Ellington. He picked five records that I think meant something to him and that he thought I might like.
Well, let's start with this one. Okay. Bird and Diz, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
That was a record that dates from around about 1950. And from someone who was listening to rock and roll and blues, the speed of it and the intensity of it just knocked me out. I mean, the first tune on the record is Bloom Dito, but the tune that I picked for us to hear is Relaxin' with Lee, which is a little bit of a slower tune, but right off the top you can hear that distinctive Charlie Parker alto saxophone sound. It's just, whenever I hear him, and I think, you know, a lot of jazz fans, you can just immediately say that's Bird.
What else do you like about it?
The voice. He's talking to you. I mean, it's just, you can hear right in the beginning, just the short phrases. And it really is like a human voice speaking through an instrument.
Linda, Tom Cole goes on to speak about the emotional intensity of the records he selected, the five that he selected, and Michelle admits to being a little intimidated by jazz because it's such a looming presence, you know, in our cultural landscape, as is the case with a lot of people. Is it the case with you?
It is the case with me a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, like a lot of people, I have some background in some kinds of jazz in terms of listening. You know, it can be a little intimidating if you feel like you don't.
Well, that's what we're trying to do with the Take 5 series, is people can learn about jazz five songs at a time, Take 5 being a famous song title from Dave Brubeck.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see these lists at our website, nprmusic.org. Now, one song I think that many non-jazz fans know is Take the A-Train.
I know that one.
Last week was the 110th anniversary of the birth of jazz legend Duke Ellington. And in honor of the anniversary, New Yorkers got to ride a special 1939-era train along the subway line made famous by the tune, including a live band in the subway car.
Wow, getting New Yorkers to get on the subway for extra time voluntarily, they really have to care about what you're doing.
NPR's Robert Smith went underground for the party.
So on Duke Ellington's birthday, where else are you going to go? You're going to go to the A train. I'm here at 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, waiting for the next train, and even the young people here know the name.
Duke was the man. If you don't know, that's one of the pioneers of music.
He was a great jazz musician. He was predominantly famous in the 1940s and 50s for his music.
I think that's it.
That's the rhythm of the train there, rhythm of the A-train.
Yep, definitely. Choo, choo, choo,
choo. Joseph Sales and Impressed Brightly are headed for Brooklyn, but they're in for a treat today because the MTA is running a special train in celebration of Duke Ellington's birthday. And here it comes into the station. It's an old-fashioned 1939 A-train.
The old A-train, the best A-train.
Well, inside is the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Let's get on board. So you have to picture this inside a fully restored A-train as the 16-member orchestra, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and I'm here with one of the sax players. What's your name?
Jason Marshall.
Jason Marshall. What's it like trying to play on this train?
A hazardous honor.
A hazardous honor. Well, people seem to be enjoying it.
Absolutely.
Also here is Paul Ellington. That's the grandson of Duke Ellington.
I think everyone's having a good time, and certainly the spectacle of the band playing on the A-train is quite intriguing.
Yeah, people are amazed when you pull into the station.
Some of them are upset, some of them are, like, interested and curious, but either way, it's doing what it's supposed to do.
The antique train is going all the way to JFK Airport, but I got to get out here in Brooklyn. Robert Smith, NPR News, waving goodbye to the antique A-train here at High Street in Brooklyn.
You know, the backstory behind that song is actually written by Duke Ellington's composing compadre, Billy Strayhorn. And he wrote it in probably a shorter time than it took to actually wait for the A-train.
That can't take a while.
He was coming in from Pittsburgh, and Duke Ellington said, come up and see me in Sugar Hill. And he gave him the directions. You take the A-train to get up to Sugar Hill. And if you find a lyrical version of the song, the songs are, you take the A-train to Sugar Hill to get to the greatest place in Harlem, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the backstory behind that tune. Very, very popular song and something that everybody recognizes.
Absolutely, even a non-jazz fan such as myself.
And I kind of got that idea, Linda, by reading the Monkey See blog.
Uh-huh.
I get an idea of kind of the stuff that you are interested in. And I've been seeing something interesting on there recently. You want to tell us about it?
I saw a video last week, and it's been kicking around the internet a little bit and getting a lot of attention. There's the chorus of PS22, which is an elementary school in Staten Island, has been posting videos of them singing various songs on the internet, and they've been getting lots and lots and lots of fans. And their big one last week was their performance of Eye of the Tiger, the 1982 non-classic theme song from Rocky III. And they got a lot of play with this video.
All right, let's listen.
Rising up.
So that's what they sound like, although I have to say, in order to fully appreciate how really fantastic this video is, you have to actually see it. We have it up on the blog at Monkey See, and you have to see the emoting, and they've got their hands over their hearts, and they're dancing, and they're so into it, and you can hear the teacher, you know, when the soloist kicks in, you can kind of hear the teacher say, sing it, Jared, and, you know, they're having the best time.
And the best way to fully appreciate this podcast is to subscribe to it and tell your friends to subscribe to
Culturetopia, NPR's podcast bringing you everything in culture from jazz all the way to Eye the Tiger.
Rock on. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Linda Holmes.